Aaron.
Rick Greenberg.
Go ahead.
Good morning, America. Want to bring this House Committee on Veterans Affairs to order this morning. It is Tuesday, March the 15th, and we're feeling very lucky today. We have four bills on behalf of our beloved veterans, and with good luck, we'll breeze through those and possibly get out early today. I first want to compliment Paula Brown and Director Willis for a beautiful, what do we call that, celebration at the Department of Veterans Affairs. It was what birthday? The 60th anniversary, and it was just awesome. Thank you. And appreciate very much the good governor being there and supporting our issues. And it was an honor to also meet General Pritt, who will be heading the entire retraining of the Afghanistan Army in 2 months. And he's will be the chief of all, as I understand. So that was a great honor, and he'll be joining us in a couple weeks here to tell us what is going on over there. And it was really a great honor. It was also a wonderful tribute to a family that has contributed in three generations to the peace on earth and freedom, and a great display. So I think y'all saw it when you toured over there. And so it was just a wonderful celebration. This time I'd like to recognize those who served in the military. If you'd stand, please. We'd like to express our deepest appreciation.
Sure.
Thank you so much for your dedication and courage and professionalism. I'm now going to open a work session on House Bill 2192.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2192 you heard on the 8th of February. This is the bill that exempts state employers from continuing the health coverage for an employee on military leave if that employee's leave is with the Active Guard Reserve Program. And you have two amendments. The first, the dash one, was adopted in conceptual form. It extends the time period for agency health plan coverage for public employees subject to involuntary military call-up from 12 months up to 24 months. We have another amendment for your possible consideration, which extends time period for agency health plan coverage for public employees subject to involuntary military call-up to the duration of the leave. And the dash one was Representative Combs.
Adjustment. You left that hanging in the air. Oh, good. Okay.
How about,
could you give the
Representative Combs
punctuation marks too, please? Representative Combs, would you like to speak to this amendment, please?
Well, my only comments would be is to our purpose here is to ensure that our veterans, our active duty service people, have health care. And depending upon, you know, what that implies, and as all of us know, sometimes when we join a health care provider, and it takes time to get everything processed. And so I just believe that a total of 24 months would make sure, absolutely, put all the safety nets that we need underneath our service people when they return.
This is a very, very good comment. Any other discussion?
Madam Chair, the dash ones have been adopted, so you could go ahead and either amend it further, or you could pass it to the floor as amended, or use a wide range of things that you could do at this point.
Okay. Well, Administrator Stembridge, the dash two, unless I hear any directive, is one that we would not want to cover.
Madam Chair, we put in the dash twos because after you met, there were some suggestions that 24 months might not be enough. And we worked with Representative Comp. Representative Comp said it was okay to draft that amendment, and then we looked at it, and it sounds to me like Representative Comp wants to stay with the dash one.
I would. Okay. I think that's sufficient.
Okay. Is there any other discussion?
No.
Okay. If not, I'm going to close the work session.
Okay. Well, you want to, if you're going to vote on it, you want to keep the work session open.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Excuse me. I beg your pardon. We will not close the work session.
You need to end work session if you're going to pass it to the floor.
Do I need a motion?
You need a motion.
Madam.
Yes, Representative Boquist, help me out this morning. I'm kind of, please.
Madam Chair, I move that we move House Bill 2192 as amended with the dash one amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
I think it's wise. You can do it without objection, but I would suggest that any time you pass a bill to the floor, that you do a roll call vote.
Okay. Representative Bruin has moved that we adopt the dash one amendment, which is now included in House Bill 2192. Is there any objection? If not, may we have a roll call?
Representative Barnhart.
Absent.
Representative Boquist.
Yes.
Representative Bruin.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Excuse, she has the flu.
Representative Hunt.
Aye.
Representative Hunt.
Aye.
Chair
Nelson. Aye.
I think this is what you have done. You might want to just ask the members if they understand that this is
okay.
What you've done.
Okay. Members, do you understand that we have moved House Bill 2192 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation?
Yes.
And having a unanimous vote in favor of this House Bill 2192 with a dash one amendment passed?
Madam Chair. Just a question. Yeah, thank you. Would this be, and I know there was a conversation I didn't hear, would this be one that we'd want to move with a consent recommendation?
Thank you for asking. What we were discussing, my concern was when we have an amendment, it is usually better to have someone carry a bill that is amended for House session. And Representative Comp, would you like to carry this bill?
I'd be honored.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And now, Madam Chair.
Now I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2192, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2665.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2665 changes the eligibility for appointment as the Oregon Adjutant General from officers of the Oregon National Guard to retired or reserve officers of the United States Armed Forces. It authorizes the governor to give preference to a current or retired member of the Oregon National Guard. You have the dash one amendment from Representative Boquist that would restore National Guard eligibility. I don't know. Aaron, did we have additional copies of the dash one to pass out? I have them here.
Would you?
For sure.
Okay. Would you mind to go through this dash one? Representative Felton?
I'd be happy. Delighted to. The original intent of 2665 is to provide the governor options should he not find, based on force deployments, qualifications, and a whole host of issues, not find a serving Oregon Army National Guard officer, that he can look outside of the box. And as you well know, and in previous testimony we've heard across the board, I mean, we're moving towards a one-army concept. And so the qualifications are equal across the board. When I sent the bill downstairs for drafting, it came back slightly different than what I anticipated. And, of course, it was the last day. And so we introduced the bill as was introduced. And, as you know, we had some discussions of they had deleted some lines, I guess, unintentionally. from their draft downstairs, and rather than go back and undelete, redelete, amend, so on and so forth, we looked at going back in and just putting language back in to ensure preference is given up front to serving members of the Oregon National Guard. What we're doing here in the end is providing an option should the governor, for various reasons, especially in an age where we're seeing up to 2,000 soldiers deployed overseas simultaneously, we might not necessarily have the best qualified candidate at hand, but there may be another Oregonian from another service, or in many cases, even in the case of General Reese himself, we have found historically that in order for him to get promoted, he had to leave the Oregon Army National Guard and go to another state. In fact, was in another state at the time of his original selection. And so then there had to be some paperwork shuffling done very quickly to get him out of that state, move him back to this state, so on and so forth. And again, what we're trying to do here is simply provide the governor the options in the future based on what we have.
Administrator Stembridge, do you need to explain this further?
Yes. Well, I can if you'd like. If you look on the amendment, it says delete lines 12 through 16 and insert. So this is what this is a new section 2, subsection 2 of section 1. And the old one deletes Oregon National Guard. The new one, you see, it says National Guard or the Armed Forces of the United States or reserve components of the Armed Forces. That's the more technical explanation of what Representative Volkus was describing.
Yeah. Hey, are there any questions? No. Okay. I'll entertain public testimony. Colonel Caldwell. And Mr. Is it Noteboom?
Noteboom, that's correct.
Thank you. Nice to have you back in Oregon, Colonel Caldwell. We missed you.
Well, the weather is certainly much better here than it was in Washington, D.C.
Are the trees as pretty in Washington, D.C. as they are here?
No, ma'am. They're certainly not. They're sticks. They're no blooms yet. And so we didn't get there for any of the pleasantries of the cherry blossoms. They are not quite out yet. When it's 21 degrees at night, they have a tendency to not bloom. So.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name for the record is Colonel Mike Caldwell with the Oregon Military Department. With me today is Colonel retired Jim Noteboom. Jim is a former Judge Advocate General, head Judge Advocate General for the Oregon National Guard. Served 35 years in uniform, started out as a Marine and served in Vietnam and then came home and is a practicing attorney in Bend with a law firm over there. And I asked Jim if he would come today and make some comments reference to this measure from his perspective as 35 years in the active component and the Guard, and also from his perspective as a judge advocate and a lawyer. So I'm going to let Jim talk first, and then I'll follow up.
Thank you so much. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. Mike got my resume almost
right. You're going to have to identify yourself.
I'm Jim Noteboom. I'm an attorney with the Carnot Peterson firm in Bend.
Thank you, sir.
And I actually spent 39 years in the military.
Well.
My first year was in the Navy as an NROTC midshipman, and then I spent 11 years in the Marine Corps as an artillery officer. And then I spent 27 years in the Oregon Army National Guard, 3 years as an infantry company commander when I was in law school, and then 24 years as a judge advocate. And I've maintained an interest in the Guard. My son returns from Iraq with the Guard this week, and so he'll be coming back. And
what is his name?
His name is Aaron Noteboom, and he, like me, was an artillery officer in the Marine Corps. Then he went to law school, and he joined the Guard like I did, and so I'm very proud of him. And
does he live in Oregon?
Yes, yes.
Oh, will you please let him know how proud we are of him and grateful?
I sure will. Sure will. The legislation here, I think, is very well intended, and I understand sort of the motivation behind it in terms of widening the pool. But I'd like to caution the committee on a couple things. One, I think it's fair to say that the Guard would view this in many respects as a vote of no confidence if it was passed. And let me explain that, because there's a lot of history and information behind that. The Oregon Guard, like all military units, has a proud tradition. We have a lot of unit cohesion, a lot of esprit de corps. And we like to believe that we have the leadership to lead this organization. And to open sort of the ability to be the senior person here to an officer, and maybe a very good officer, that has never spent a day in the Oregon National Guard would be a problem to a lot of Guard officers. Guard officers, like their active duty counterparts, view the military as a calling. And in some respects, it's even greater calling for reservists, because we have a full-time career and we give up our weekends and our vacations to perform this military service. And we have a lot of history in the Oregon National Guard. The 41st Division was the predecessor of the 41st Brigade, a famous unit in World War II. And history goes back. And so it's like any organization that has that type of cohesion. If a total stranger is brought in to be the leader of that organization, what does it say about the governor's confidence in these people that have dedicated 15, 20, 30 years of their lives moving up the ranks and trying to build the organization? So I think there's a real issue there, and there could be a real misperception, I think, on the part of many Guard members, particularly leadership in the Guard. The second point I'd like to make is that there are good reasons for the provisions in the current statute. Let me give you a couple of examples. One, there is a requirement they spend 6 years in the Guard. We are one army, and we are one military. But having said that, there are important differences that are important to understand and take into account. Many of the members of the Guard, like myself, have active duty experience. General Reese, who is coming back, had active duty experience. So there is lots of active duty experience within the Guard. In addition, after the last couple of years, there are going to be literally thousands of Guard members with active duty experience. But the Guard is a unique animal. It is, in some important respects, fundamentally different from the military. The Guard is the militia of the U.S. Constitution. Most of the time that a man or woman is a member of the Guard, the governor is the commander-in-chief. The governor runs the organization. We have a state mission. It's an extraordinarily important state mission. And an active duty officer comes from a fundamentally different orientation. The president is always the commander-in-chief. And I've seen active duty officers struggle with this concept, that how can this be that, by God, we serve the president and that's it. And so the six-year requirement is sort of an initiation to understand, and it takes a while to come to understand, the importance of this dual role, that is, a state militia and a reserve component of the active duty forces. And so it is important to have experience in the Guard and to know the people and understand the civilian leadership that oversees the Guard in Oregon. The requirement that it be a lieutenant colonel or above ensures that there will be a seasoned officer. And these requirements have been in the statute a long time, and they were a result, at least from my understanding of the history of the Guard, of some unfortunate experiences in the past. During World War II, there was largely a wholesale change of Guard divisions when they were mobilized, and the existing Guard leadership was taken out and active duty personnel were inserted, and that caused a lot of heartburn among folks. I've seen personally a couple of instances, because not all states have these requirements. Each state is different in their requirement. And I've seen a couple of instances now in which active duty forces were, or officers were brought in as the adjutant general, and the cases I'm familiar with, it caused just the types of problems that I've described for you. That is resentment among the existing members that an outsider who's never spent a day with them before and may have had some connection with the governor has been brought in now to oversee it. So I think that the existing legislation really does serve us well. This potentially opens up the door to some unintended consequences, and I hope the committee will sort of understand that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Colonel Noteboom.
Yes.
Right? Got it. Could you tell me, do all states have the previous statute?
No.
What are other differences in
every state? Some do allow officers from any service to come in.
They do.
And some don't require any prior membership in the Oregon National Guard or in the National Guard of that state. It's just sort of all over the map, but a lot of states have put in these types of restrictions or qualifications to ensure that they don't run into some of those problems. And I think that's what Oregon did 40 years ago.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, for the record, Colonel Caldwell, I think the change that's suggested here is a rather new phenomenon that's occurred in the last 20 years, I think, across the country. It's been in several different states that's been the case. Some of that I think you can look at in large part as the Army shifted its focus after the Cold War, and there was a drawdown of the active component. There was quite a move by the active component to try to find, you know, billets, if you will, for their members. And so there was a lot of push in the late 80s, early 90s to get states to do exactly this, in order to find homes for their officers. And good Americans, good serving, but getting back to what Jim said, you know, there is a built-in resentment, I think, if they haven't served any time in the institution that they're asked to lead. The Guard is different than the active component, is again, as Jim indicated, with the basis of the militia in the Constitution. It's certainly been something that we keep near and dear to our hearts. And we have a community involvement that not typically you'll find on an active duty base, maybe certainly around it, but we're statewide. We're 38 armories. We have 38 personalities out there. Our objective has always been to keep commanders at the local level. So we don't move commanders from, say, from Burns to Goose Bay to command. We try to grow our officers and our leadership in the local community and have them serve that local community because they have a better understanding of the needs of that local community. We're not like the active duty. They live on a gated cul-de-sac. We live on Main Street. And we draw our people from Main Street. And that's who we serve. The butcher, baker, candlestick maker are our members. And that's important to us. So having those roots inside that system are extremely valuable. One of the things that we were criticized for back in the 80s and in the early 90s was that the Guard was so much different than the active component that we couldn't play in the same league, if you will. And that simply was, you know, I think a vision that lack of understanding on the active duties part. We tried very hard. I think the Guard really did improve the training, improve the leadership. We go to the same schools that the active component does. We don't have two separate schools. We get the same doctrine. And I think there was a good melding of the two forces in the active component as well as the reserve component to try to break down some of those barriers. Nevertheless, they still exist. Representative Hooley has a bill that she's trying to get traction with in the Congress right now that would force the active component to not be able to promote somebody to general officer unless they've served 2 years in a billet in the Guard or Reserve, to try to break down that, you know, this environment that's existed in my 35 years. It's always that way. We've had soldiers walk into health care treatment facilities at Fort Hood. They look at the patch on their shoulder and say, well, you're in the Guard. We're not going to treat you. You know, and this is a fact. This is an honest-to-God fact. At one point, I can remember when I was commanding a battalion, we were rounded out to the 4th Infantry Division. I had a 4th Infantry Division patch on. That was a decision that was made, that we wore those division patches. Young soldier, I was standing in the line of the PX, and he said, you know, he was courteous, said, sir, how you doing? I said, fine. And he said, are you in the Guard, or are you in the 4th Division? And I looked at the patch, and I said, son, I'm in both. So, you know, there is a stigma, there is a wall. It's always been there as long as I've been around. I think it's a national issue. I don't think it's necessarily at this level. I think our people are equal to the task or better than most of the folks that I've seen on active duty. And I think the 2162's example in Iraq over the last year is a shining example of what you can bring, you know, an average American patriot, citizen soldier into the mix, and they do an outstanding job.
If I could add a little to what Mike said, Madam Chair, I've been a student of the military for a long time, and when I was active duty in the Marine Corps, I had a bad attitude about the Marine Reserves, and that was a part of the game. There's been a lot of progress in sort of melding the forces here in the last 20 years. The Marine Corps and the Air Force have done superb jobs in terms of building one Air Force, one Marine Corps. They're all viewed the same. The Navy has done a so-so job, and the Army has done an abysmal job. And those differences are serious. I'm not here to point fingers. I think there's enough blame on all sides for that. But that is the fact of life. And I can confirm from things my son has told me that things haven't changed since I left the Guard, that is still there. And so that just adds another sort of layer here. If you bring on now an active duty force to the group that just came back from Iraq and are very proud of what they did, they're again saying, well, wait, aren't we good enough?
Very well taken, Colonel Caldwell and Colonel Noteboom. At this time, I want to just pause and introduce just stay where you are, please, an incredible group of young people. I'm so proud of them. These are students from the Opportunity House in Sheridan, which is run by a friend of mine who has done an incredible job, Mina Deck, and I've known her for 30-something years. And would you students and your sponsors stand, and we'd like to recognize you. We're very proud that you would come and be a part of our government today. We're proud of you. And for your information, I'm not sure we have the forms. We are discussing a proposed piece of legislation here in our committee. This is the first time in the history of the state of Oregon since February 14, 1859, that we have ever had a committee on veteran affairs, and we take this mission very seriously. Our veterans have secured our future. We feel we have a tremendous responsibility to secure theirs with dedication and commitment. They risk their lives and to keep us free, and we know freedom wasn't and isn't free. So I'm proud that you're here today in support of our military. This morning, I heard the number is 430,000 National Guard men and women who have served in this crisis in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I was thinking last week, I believe we talked about the entire number being 1 million. So the truth is our National Guard is half of that, and we're very proud of all the accomplishment. The 162nd, which is going to be here when, Colonel Caldwell, home?
Madam Chair, the 2162 is currently in Kuwait. They're scheduled to arrive Fort Lewis yesterday. We were told their first airplane should arrive Friday evening or Saturday morning. We're not sure exactly which yet, depending on the airflow. And they should all be back at Fort Lewis by this weekend. Our intention right now is to have a return ceremony at the Oregon State Fairgrounds on the 31st at 16:30 hours, 4:30 in the afternoon, for those of you that don't want to do the math, and we'd certainly invite everybody in this committee and the entire legislature. We'll be sending out as quick as we confirm it. Please put that tentative right now, because we don't know the airflow precisely. We don't know until they land, factually.
Sure.
But our intention is to have them home on Friday, next Friday, week from this Friday, and here in Salem. We're using the new building at the fairgrounds because, frankly, we can't find a place big enough in Eugene at this point. We sent them away from the fairgrounds in Eugene. We know that will not hold this crowd that's going to come for their return. So we've decided to do it here and then distribute them from here at home.
Well, we are so proud to be a part of this. That would be great. All right. Any other questions?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Representative Bolkley.
Thank you.
Excuse me just a minute, just for the benefit of our students. The bill, I didn't finish, this House Bill 2192, sorry, 2665, changes the eligibility for appointment as the Oregon Adjutant General from officers of the National Guard, Oregon National Guard, to retired or reserved officers of any of the armed forces. And it authorizes the governor to give preference to a current or retired member of the Oregon National Guard. And we have just heard testimony from Colonel Caldwell and Colonel Noteboom that that might cause some heartburn with a number of our National Guard who have a kinship to this position. Representative Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What we're focusing on, Madam Chair, is the future, not the past. However, unfortunately, there are times where we have to look at the past to get to where we're going. And I believe, correct me if I'm not mistaken, Colonel Hilton, you were the chief lawyer for General Reese during two previous tours of Adjutant General. Is that correct?
Not during his first term. Colonel Lockwood was there then. I was there during his second.
Thank you. Follow up, Madam Chair. You raised the issue of a vote of no confidence. Colonel Caldwell, correct me if I'm wrong, hasn't there been nearly 20 lieutenant colonels or colonels from the Oregon National Guard who have served in combat, in harm's way, in Kosovo, Bosnia, Afghanistan, or Iraq? Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Boquist, I haven't done the math, but I suspect that it's, I don't think it's as high as 20, but it's probably 12 to 15, I would guess.
Thank you. Follow up, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Colonel Noble, you're talking about a vote of no confidence. If you're in an organization that has 15 to 20 colonels, much like yourself, though you're retired, and we definitely appreciate your service, and of those 15 or 20, they look at someone who is brought back for a third time over a 17-year period. How does that speak to a vote of no confidence to those 12 to 15 or 20 officers if they're not considered qualified enough to be the Adjutant General of the State of Oregon?
Let me answer that in a couple of different ways. One, I've known General Reese for much longer than he's been the Adjutant General. We were company commanders together in 2 of the 162 back in the 70s. General Reese is one of the most extraordinary officers I've ever met in my military career in any branch of the service. I mean, he is truly an extraordinary officer. And I can't speak for Governor Kulongoski, but this is as critical a period for the Oregon National Guard as it's probably ever had. And the opportunity to get someone of General Reese's ability and stature, to me, is a hard thing to pass up. Now, I don't know what General Reese's equation was. I also know from many years in dealing with General Reese that he is dedicated to the idea of career development, moving people in a managed way, and not letting people homestead in a position. He moves them up and out. Ultimately, it's the governor's call as to how he's going to reconcile those sort of conflicting issues. But again, at this stage in the history of the Oregon National Guard, I think having General Reese for the third time be the Adjutant General. I realize that others could make a different call in that regard, but I, knowing the people, I view that as the case.
Madam Chair, follow up.
Representative Boquist.
Colonel Caldwell, there are obviously challenges with equipping and training the National Guard force here in Oregon, because we've faced this with the deployment of the two of the 162. We've seen shortages in equipment, MTOE equipment. We've seen same problems that this committee has not seen with the 116, and those are being resolved. And General Byrne and Colonel Caldwell, my hats are off to them, Madam Chair, because they have addressed those issues the best they can. But who's in the structure and forming, who is responsible at the national level for supporting the National Guard and getting them the equipment that they need prior to their deployment, training, mentoring, all of that? Colonel Caldwell.
Madam Chair, Representative Boquist, I think ultimately it's Congress. I mean, as you well know, being a product of a recipient of the acts and deeds of Congress vis-a-vis through the Department of Defense, without the Congress setting the standard and without the Congress leaning forward and insisting that the Guard and Reserve receive the equipment, no one person, no collection of people at the DOD or the National Guard Bureau level, which is what we deal through, can get those kind of resources. It's just a simple matter of it's impossible without that support. So I think ultimately the credit or the blame rests with the members of Congress. I think going to what you're talking about specifically, in our case, I think as with any organization where you have competing interests, the Guard, the Reserve, the active component, the most important thing that I think we can offer as a state, particularly a state who does not have senior leadership in the Congress, which we all know that we did very well in Senator Hatfield's era because we had chairman of appropriations, so the Guard in general was taken care of because Hatfield was a former governor and he recognized the importance, and he also took care of Oregon, you know, with the wink and a nod. He didn't specifically earmark things for us, but I think the understanding was clear that if he added money for a certain project or a certain list of equipment, whether it be SINGARs, radios, Humvees, whatever the case may be, that Oregon was going to be taken care of. And that's exactly how it happened. Now, without Senator Hatfield, it becomes a much more difficult situation for us as a state to deal in that environment. The most important thing that we can do in that environment is put our absolute best person possible at that big table. And that big table is dealing with a whole bunch of other major generals from the other states, as well as those people inside the Bureau. And again, I think following up with what Jim said in Major General Reese's position, or his particular situation, we could probably have no better person. Because one, he knows the players at the Bureau because he's been there. Two, he has great respect amongst the other adjutants, generals. And three, he can deal on that level that instantly without any train-up period, which anybody else would require and also have to cut their own teeth in that environment. And I think the reality is that he's going to lend a big hand to having given us a big jump at the table. I think back to your other comment, reference other members of the Guard, other officers in the Guard, and there's clearly a very fine list of very good officers in the National Guard. And I think the fact that the governor was able to delay for 18 months speaks volumes of the quality of the officers and the leadership that we have in the Oregon Guard. Had he not had that quality, had he not had that ability inside this organization, he could not have waited 18 months. It simply couldn't have happened. Last comment I'm going to make with regard to our officer leadership, we also have a Major General serving in SINCPAC right now, Major General Rosenfeld, who is an Oregon Guardsman, Oregon State University professor, running the campus in Bend right now. General Rosenfeld was selected from a whole pool of Guard and Reservists and has held that position. He held a position in Korea, and he's held a position at the command of the Pacific as a Major General. So I think we've done an excellent job in the Oregon Guard over the last decade of creating good quality officers. And these folks have paid us dividends in many, many different ways. So, I guess if it isn't broke, we don't need to fix it, is my point. And I just don't think it's broke.
Madam Chair. Hold up.
Excuse me just one moment, please, Representative Boquist. When does General Reese take over the reign here at the Oregon Guard?
Madam Chair, right now General Reese is scheduled to depart from NORAD on or around the 1st of May. He should be back in the state by the 15th of May. There's a period of time that will some leave he's going to burn up that he still has on Title 10 before he can convert over to the Adjutant General. So it'd be post 15 May would be my guess.
Yeah, Representative Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the benefit of the committee, I mean, General Reese has served exceptionally. I would agree with Colonel Noteboom and Colonel Caldwell. And he is going to be the next Adjutant General. What we're trying to focus on is what's next.
Is the Adjutant General, could you give us the definition, Representative Boquist?
The Adjutant General is the serving senior military officer for the Oregon National Guard, which includes the Air National Guard and includes the Army National Guard. Now, in the case of General Reese, he was the Adjutant General two times before. He's been appointed through four governors to that position. So this will be his third time that he served as Adjutant General. And he is a good officer. I'm not going to dispute that with these good colonels. He was, for 7 years, he was either the chief of the National Guard Bureau, the vice chief, acting chief of the National Guard, vice chief of the National Guard Bureau, and the director of the Army National Guard. And he was the sole officer and many times responsible for leading the effort for training and equipping the National Guard across the entire country. So he's been in the fray for more than 7 years. He definitively knows the system. And again, he served exceptionally well, and I would agree with both colonels. We are getting to a point where we have a because of the adjutant generals across the states, you now have a newer generation of soldiers that are from the Army Reserve, as we hear across here, from the Marine Corps Reserve, from the National Guard and from the active duty, who are all gaining combat experience and are going to be the next leaders in the generations to come. And we're rapidly, basically, in a third world war, a war on terror. And so you've got young officers rapidly moving from captain to lieutenant colonel to colonel in a vast, you know, speed. And the concept, unfortunately, of militia that we all envision is changing, whether we agree or disagree. And I think that, I mean, a definition of militia, well, on the edge of the committee, Madam Chair, is a militia for our purposes is not the militia people talk about in the Second Amendment. It's not there. I mean, the Oregon National Guard, an example, is not allowed to maintain ammunition. So the governor cannot call it up as a balance of power issue. What we use the militia for is to support in natural disasters, in fires. And, of course, we're sorely going to miss them, like the state of Washington and the fires that come up. But, again, my focus is on the future. I think General Reese can be an exceptional asset to the state of Oregon. There's no two ways about that. That's not the issue at hand. The issue at hand is, you know, what is the confidence for those colonels that are out there? And a record can show that I've had no less than a dozen senior officers contact me, and all of them are actually in the exact opposite camp of the two gentlemen sitting here. And it's not a statement. It's just a statement of fact. We now have young, hard-charging officers who are presently serving, who have lost and been bloodied in combat, who see things differently. And they're interested in the future and what happens in the future. And my final question, I mean, the Oregon National Guard, and I think Colonel Caldwell and Colonel Noteboom, whether we agree or disagree, you know, is part of the one army, and we're trying to make it work. And the one army, and even in the Oregon National Guard, can you tell me, Colonel Caldwell, how many active duty officers have we brought back? Because we brought back quite a few, and they've actually become National Guard officers. Because we're saying here in this bill is we're still going to require 6 years of National Guard service at some point. But we have brought a tremendous amount, and General Reese was instrumental in bringing a tremendous amount of active duty officers back to this state.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Boquist, that's true. We've always looked for good officers, no matter where we could find them. And quite often, what we have found is that officers who get off of active duty typically at the captain level, about 9-10 years. They usually have a change in lifestyle because of family relationships and or other causes. They still want to serve their country. They still want to be in uniform. They still want to have something to do with that. But yet their deployments have been so extensive and so often that their family life is suffering, so they choose to leave active duty and they come to the Guard or the Reserve in order to try to continue on with their career. So we have a vast number of them. I don't know the exact number, but I'd say probably the at least a third of our officers have done some form of active duty before they come to us. So that's not unusual. I will also tell you that those officers, those young officers, come in at a captain level typically because there's more space for them at that level. We typically do not bring in active duty people at major, lieutenant colonel, or colonel level because we simply have too few slots. And you've got people who have worked 25, 30 years competing for those slots, and suddenly somebody comes off of active duty because they're tired of the active duty life and they want to take over that slot. We just don't allow that unless it's an exception, a rare exception. I can't think of any, frankly. I think of one major that we brought in my 35 years that I can recall. And frankly, he didn't do well. He managed to get to lieutenant colonel, but he retired immediately when he got there because he just didn't do well. He'd been cut too many years in that environment. So I think there's a lesson that we've learned, I think, over the years, that if you're going to bring people in, you bring them in young. You bring them in so they can spend that time at that local armory. They can get to know the mayor of the town. They can get to know the school superintendent and the principals and those sort of things that we draw our soldiers from. Without that kind of a relationship, we can't survive, we can't exist. And all too often when an active duty person comes in, they're thinking active duty, and we are not the active duty. And if we want, and my theory has always been, if you want to be on active duty, go on active duty. You know, if the option's there, take your pick, you know, because we're different. So I think, finally, and I think Jim said it best, I know the intentions are good. There is one, if those six or seven officers that have come to you that have said this is not a good deal for the Oregon Guard, I would disagree with them vehemently. I've known General Reese for 30 years. I agree with Jim wholeheartedly. I met him when I was in OCS, and he walked on the stage, and I knew immediately this guy was different than any officer I'd ever been around. And he's proven that every step of the way. I've been a student under him for that period of time. I feel that I've learned a great deal. I've grown a great deal. And it's made me a better person, and it's made me a better officer because I've had that opportunity. And regardless of what happens with the future of the Oregon Guard, General Reese will retire at age 64 because our current statutory language requires that you maintain your federal recognition, as federal law requires. At age 64, you lose your federal recognition as a major general. So regardless of what happens here today with this bill or any other actions that any previous governor may want, this gentleman will retire at age 64.
How old is he now?
He's 61.
61 now, so we have him for 3 years.
Right. And I think, back to Jim's point, I think this is a critical point.
Years,
yes, ma'am.
Take
yeah.
his position,
yes, ma'am.
Like, just like business, you commit to a certain...
Yes, ma'am, he has. And so I think we're at a critical juncture. Representative Boquist is absolutely correct. There has been no more important opportunity, no more important time. The reason we don't have equipment right now is because Oregon, as I said earlier, was blessed with the ability. We had a friend in the factory with General Reese at the head of the Guard Bureau, or the Vice Chief, or the Acting Chief, or the Director of the Army Guard. We had Senator Hatfield. Our equipment was pristine. We had full accounting of it. We had full numbers of it. When the war started, there were other states that didn't have that. Again, back to Congress, not funding the proper amount to do that. And we shipped our equipment to other states that deployed before we did. We kept enough to deploy our people. We do not have enough equipment to deploy General Pritt's brigade to Afghanistan. We will be borrowing equipment again. We'll ask other states to ship it back to us, or we'll pick it up somewhere else. Some cases we won't get it till we get there, as is the case with the 3116 in Iraq right now. They are still lacking equipment that they once had. And they didn't. We were forced to ship it to other states because of a lack of system-wide deficiencies. So they lost it, and now they're there. They've got about 80% of it back, and in some cases 90%, but they're still lacking equipment, and they once had it. So, again, having somebody in the factory, knowing how the game's played, helps you immensely. So it's a critical time for us to try to get that, because Congress is finally leaning forward to buy equipment for the Garden Reserve. But it takes time to get it purchased, takes time to get it distributed.
Yes, Congress certainly has its work cut out for it, and we're, you know, by this committee hearing today, we just once again want to say to those who are in Congress who are listening, and they do listen to our committee, get the push on, or we're going to bring buses from every state to Washington, D.C., and they'll think they've seen a lobby effort before, but we'll be showing them the best of the best when we bring all of our military veterans to the state of the state of neglect. That's where they've neglected doing what they should have done for our soldiers, but I'm not criticizing the leadership or the president. I'm just saying we know that we need some equipment, and we need some good equipment.
Well, Madam Chair, last week on our trip back to Washington, where we visited all of our delegation members, I will tell you that in the 16, 17, 18 years that I've been in this job doing this work, we have never been received quite as well as we were this last
week. All right.
Week. And we've never seen such an interest in trying to help us. So
yeah.
As dismal as things may appear at some points, it's very obvious to me that all members of our delegation, and I suspect every state's delegation, is extremely interested in trying to correct some of the ills that they have let happen.
Well, we are so proud of our Guard, and for the benefit of the students who may have read the paper recently, I can talk about our 162nd that found caches of artillery in graves in Iraq, and also found a number of missing in action individuals or missing civilians from other countries. We're incredibly proud, and that we're also very, very proud that General Pritt will be leading in Afghanistan all of the training with our Guard's assistance, with all of the training for the Afghan Army, and we're so proud. We've never been prouder. I mean, Colonel Caldwell and Colonel Jim. I'm going to get this right in a minute.
Noteboom.
Thank you for all you've done for us. Also, I want to mention that I've just added up, and we have, I think, almost 300 years of service in this room right now. I could take General Austin, and who is all here, and just knowing all the individuals who are here, I know just between Representative Boquist and Colonel Caldwell and Colonel Noteboom right here, that's almost 150 years just among you three.
Slightly over 100.
and we're feeling that. We're feeling that time, too.
And for the students, I want them to also know that Representative Brian Boquist here returned just a few months ago. He's been in 30 years, but he led a great fight in Iraq for us, and spent 7 or 8 months there this last time, and we're really grateful. Okay, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had one question, then I wanted to make a comment. Representative Boquist made a comment about ammunition. Would you amplify on that a little bit? Ammunition in the Guard.
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, presently the regulations require us that when we draw ammunition from the active component, we draw it at Fort Lewis typically, and we can store that ammunition for a certain number of days within the state of Oregon in certified bunkers that are appropriately secure and also in appropriate positions for accidents if they should occur. We're not allowed to keep a large stock of ammunition on hand permanently. So given an example, the best example I could give you would be what happened in Los Angeles 15 years ago with the LA riots, and the Cal Guard was required to deploy and with ammunition. There was a certain number of hours of delay as they acquired the ammunition from the active component and moved it to the guard units that were actually deploying. The interesting fact in that was that I did receive quite a bit of media coverage that the guard couldn't get there on time. But the interesting fact was that the guard actually showed up on the streets for the city of Los Angeles and the Los Angeles police about 6 hours before the Marine Corps showed up, and about five to six hours before the active army showed up. So I don't know if one's better or worse than the other, but the media chose to focus on the guard's inability to get there. So I think, you know, I think it is it's a safeguard. We're not, and it's also a cost-effective issue, because if we store ammunition, we've got to maintain security. And maintaining security is costly, no matter how you do it. So it's been the practice in my tenure since I've been in, that we only store it for a certain number of days as we're using it for training. And if we needed it for something akin to the Los Angeles riot, then we would have to go to Fort Lewis to get it.
Thank you. And a comment, if I might, Madam Chair. I've been reading the book that General Burns gave us. And what I'm aware of, listening to this discussion this morning, is that no matter how much things change, they actually stay quite a bit the same. Just in connection with that last comment of yours, the first skirmishes during the Revolutionary War were over trying to find powder caches that were being held near Boston by the Massachusetts militia. And, of course, the British were utterly unsuccessful in finding those powder caches, and that's part of the reason why they had trouble in Boston over the next year or so. The other comment I wanted to make was, I think that the charge of the guard to be the state militia, in the sense of knowing the mayor and the bank president and the people in town who are important and in the operation of the place, means that when you get there 6 hours earlier, you have some idea of what you're doing and what you're dealing with in that context. We certainly need the regular army for a lot of things, but the Guard has proved its importance to the United States and to Oregon over and over again in context in which the regular army would not be nearly as valuable or useful to us. What we're dealing with right now, of course, is a huge extension of the old militia that happens only in times of great peril, like the situation we've been in with the War on Terror, and earlier times like the World War II, and earlier than that, the Civil War, when the militia has been asked to move well beyond the borders of the state to work on a national mission. And so part of our task, of course, as everyone in this committee knows, is to figure out how we're going to carry out these two different charges of the National Guard, and how we're going to deal with the repercussions of the fact that the guardsmen have been asked to serve far, far away from our shores, and what that means and when they return. So I appreciate the conversation today. I just wanted to note that things haven't changed all that much in 200 years.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Okay, other comments? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
So much for being here. And as Colonel Caldwell moves to the back, I want these students to know that they have established in Bend a great school called the Youth Challenge Program. It's incredible. I think it has like a 99% graduation. It's kids attend on their own, and a number of those students have then gone into the service, been very successful, and I'm so incredibly proud of the Youth Challenge Program. That would be a great place to visit, I'll just tell the teachers today. I just think it's absolutely outstanding. It's a federal grant, I believe, right, Colonel Caldwell?
Yes, 64.
Yes, just great. All right, if there's no more public comment, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2665 and open a work session on... Open a public hearing, excuse me, not a work session, on Senate Bill 223.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 223 increases the maximum veterans' home loan from 97% to 100% of appraised value of the home.
Thank you. Is there any public testimony on this measure? Okay. We have the Assistant Director of the Department of Veteran Affairs, Paula Brown, Walter Cruz, and then Mac McDonald. And do you want to identify yourself?
Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Donald Lannerman. I'm with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm in the Loan Division.
Glad you're here, Donna.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paula Brown. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and I'm pleased to be here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 223.
Excuse me, Paula, would you move that microphone over in front of you so...
A little closer? How's that?
Yeah, there.
Is that better?
Thank you, so everybody can hear.
Yes. I have with me today Donna Landerman. She's our department loan, home loan origination manager. Bruce Shriver, if either of them are called upon to answer questions, they can identify themselves for the record. Don already has. Bruce can do that. The Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs has been making home loans to qualified veterans since 1945. Since that time, the department has made more than 333,000 home loans with a positive economic impact to the state of more than $7.4 billion.
Dollars. How, since 1945, 333,000 home loans, and are those for homes in the state?
That is correct. Yes, Madam Chair.
It cannot be anywhere outside of Oregon.
That is correct. It's inside the state of Oregon.
And when you say a positive economic impact of more than $7.4 billion, what do you mean by the economic impact?
Well, it would... I think I'll defer to my chief financial officer so that I don't mess that question up for you,
okay,
Madam Chair. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bruce Shriver, Chief Financial Officer, Department of Veterans Affairs. Sorry. That $7.4 billion figure is the amount of bonds that have been issued and monies lent. So $7.4 billion was lent in those 333,000 loans. It doesn't include any multiplier effects at all.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, and to continue, included in the positive economic impact of the state, of course, there are the industries, the construction industries as well, that feel the positive impact of those home constructions.
Has there been a predominant area where these homes have been built?
Madam Chair, I don't know the exact location of all the homes. I know that we have made home loans across the entire state of Oregon.
Thank you.
Senate Bill 223 would allow the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs to make a home loan up to a maximum of 100% of the net appraised value on homes that are real property. Currently, that amount is 97%. And you'll see in my written testimony that I've provided a few bullets of exactly what we feel this legislation would accomplish. It would give the director the flexibility of being able to offer an additional home loan product to eligible qualified veterans. It would increase the number of Oregon veterans in the already existing pool. It gives them an opportunity for home ownership.
Do we have a, excuse me, Paula, Donna, do we have a waiting list? Want home loans at this time?
An actual waiting list. We take care of them as they come through, so an actual waiting list we don't have. We do have several in line.
Great.
One of the most important things that this piece of legislation would do is it would reduce the upfront cost to borrowers. We currently see, and primarily a lot of times it's the young families who have the repayment ability, however they lack the 3% down payment. What this does is takes away the requirement that they have the 3% down payment. They still have the ability to pay the loan, so it's still a good loan for both them and for the department.
So may I ask, are all veterans eligible for these loans? Does this include the Oregon National Guard and the reserves? And the Merchant Marines, one lady asked me the other day, said, we were only recognized in 1988. So, but can all...
Madam Chair, there are some restrictions. There are some restrictions on the eligibility for the home loans, and there's currently some efforts underway to extend that to National Guard. Currently, members of the National Guard who served in a theater of combat, for which an expeditionary medal is awarded, would be eligible. So for those who are serving in Afghanistan and Iraq, when they return under the current law, they are eligible. However, there are some efforts underway to amend the Constitution to extend that to those Oregon National Guard members who didn't necessarily serve in an area of combat.
There's no requirement that they serve 178 days in a combat zone or 180 days? Or
I will defer to to my loan manager here. I believe, however, if they served in an area of combat where that expeditionary medal is authorized, that qualifies them without the 180, but I will let her speak to that to make sure.
There actually is the 210-day or an expeditionary medal.
Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This legislation would also provide borrowers with an additional loan product. As you're probably aware, as homeowners are in the market to purchase a home, there are a number of home loan products available. This would make an additional product available through to them from the department. And finally, it would make an additional home loan product available to our business partners. We have business partners across the state, mortgage lenders and brokers who originate Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs home loans. A couple of things that does, it is allows the veterans applying for the loans to be able to do that in their own community without having to travel to Salem to apply for that. So our business partners across the state, it's been a very good relationship having them originate those loans. And this puts another product in their portfolio that they are able to provide to their customers that come in. The department does require mortgage default insurance on loans that are in excess of 80% of the loan-to-value ratio. This is to mitigate some of the risk.
So the veteran pays the premium for this mortgage default insurance?
That is correct. Yes, Madam Chair.
And how much does that run?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it depends on how much they put down. It's a percent of how much they put down. The higher, obviously, the less they put down, the higher that monthly payment would be. They have a choice of monthly or in.
So let's say they put down 10% the down payment on the home.
Mm-hmm.
What would the premium be for mortgage default insurance?
Again, it's based on how much they borrow.
$300,000 house.
Okay, I'll calculate it for you.
Okay, 10% on a $100,000 house. How much would my insurance be?
$130 a month.
$130 a month.
That's on $300,000.
Oh, on $300,000. Oh, that was on $300,000. So would it be a third of that? $100,000 probably. About $50 a month.
On $100,000?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
If you put 10% down, again, it's a ratio. Forgive me, I'm calculating. I hope I do it correctly. $43.33.
And to the what would the payment be?
On $100,000?
Uh-huh.
You have two choices of loans. Currently, I'm going to give you the lowest, which is at 4.99. The principal and interest payment would be $536.21.
On a $100,000 home.
Mm-hmm.
The reason that's important to me is I recently told the story of the veteran's wife in Eugene who contacted me when we were trying to save the home for Colonel Reiser, and I'd done the auction for him. And she explained to me that she wanted to help him in any way possible. She only had $5 to give, which was awesome that she could do that. But she said she stood on the street in Eugene for 1 year trying to make enough money to pay her, you know, home loan. And I just want the students to understand that, you know, there are a lot of sacrifices. Her husband became disabled. They went through their savings account very quickly, and they've made it, and I'm proud of them, and I hope she's listening. But that is a large sum of money. So it's $600 without, you know, any other, you know, changes to the home or repairs. So go ahead. Defaults, have we had many defaults with our veterans?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, back in the early 80s, mid-80s, yes, there were. There are very sizable defaults.
And why was that?
Well, a number of things contributed to that. One was the mortgage, the underwriting process may not have been as rigorous as what's being employed today.
What does that mean?
When they were qualified, looked at whether or not they had the ability to repay the loan. The evaluation may not have been as rigorous.
A qualifying homeowner, home buyer?
Yes.
Okay.
Another reason.
Need to do more due diligence?
Yes. And what the department has done since then is adopted a Fannie Mae under Federal National Mortgage Association underwriting guidelines. I digress. Last time I used acronyms and I got dang good. So,
the students to know that we have a veterans fund here and we penalize individuals for using acronyms like VA. Which is, I know, there goes a dollar right there.
Oh,
you shouldn't be afraid to testify. It goes to a good cause. Go ahead, Paul.
I was just going to say the department has since adopted more of the industry standard underwriting guidelines, this Federal National Mortgage Association underwriting guidelines. Also in the mid-80s, these mortgages were originated without mortgage insurance, so that when any defaults did occur, the department suffered the entire loss. And so, again, this is different in that any loan with a loan-to-value ratio in excess of 80% requires some form of primary mortgage insurance. And that's the entity that bears the brunt of the risk.
Is that in addition to this default insurance?
It's same thing.
Same thing?
Yes.
Okay. All right, Paul. Sorry.
That's fine, Madam Chair. So what this does is the insurance protects the agency in the event of a default on the loan. And as Bruce indicated, more stringent underwriting guidelines have also made for less risky loans, more secure loans. So this concludes my testimony, but I'd be happy to answer any questions or have one of my colleagues here assist me with that.
Thank you very much, all three of you, for being here, and thank you for your wonderful service to our veterans and their families. Donna, what would be the mortgage insurance payment on a zero-down purchase?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if it's $100,000, I'll calculate for you. Also, different mortgage insurance companies they're in the process of actually lowering that, but I'm going to raise it up for you, assuming it's that high. Currently, we're comparing a 10% down versus 100% here. That'd be 83.33, so 83.33.
And the payment would still be the 536.21?
The same, principal and interest. In a payment, you have principal and interest, taxes, insurance. So you also have homeowner's insurance besides the default.
Against flood and fire. Okay, thank you. Questions? Of the committee, Representative Bruin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the testimony. Forgive me if the old banker in me comes out just a little bit.
Oh, good.
Always have to have one. Right? My issue is that I think, you know, the charge of this committee is to enhance and to support, if you will, the enlargement of veterans' benefits. This is one that bothers me a little bit. It does not mean I'm not supporting it, but it bothers me a little bit when we start talking about 100% leverage on somebody's greatest asset. it doesn't take much for you to go upside down real quick on a home loan when you're leveraging 100% of it. And I guess this is more comment than question, but I'll steer it toward a question. Going back to sort of the default question, in your experience with the veterans home loans, those that are currently borrowing in that sort of 97% loan to value range, is there a significantly higher default average than, say, somebody in lower 90s or in the 80% range that you're seeing?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think I'll take that one if that's okay with you. In looking over our stats, surprisingly, at the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and it could be the type of clientele we have, the veterans themselves, and they're drilling in. I've often questioned that one myself. But if we look at the total picture of our defaults, that doesn't seem to be the case in our defaults. Maybe Bruce could talk to previous defaults, but over the last couple of years, that hasn't been the case. You'd think the 97s would be higher and more... I don't know the reasoning for that, but as a banker background person myself, it's the same question I had. The 100% would simply give an opportunity to those. They would have to qualify. Of course, they're actually haven't qualified for a much higher payment. So the risk factor in some ways goes down for us, and it definitely goes down for us with the private mortgage insurance or the default insurance. But the risk factor for them, again, the leverage, I agree with you wholeheartedly, but it gives them an opportunity such as the federal VA program.
Madam Chair, quick follow-up comment.
Yes, sir.
Once again, having a 97% loan-to-value doesn't give much room for mistake or wiggle room. 100% loan-to-value, 100% leverage, if the people making the home-buying decision paid too much for their house, they're up, and you don't control that. You have to use the appraisal, but it's still not. We know how appraisals work in today's housing market. They pretty much tell you what you want them to say. At least that's been my experience. I think it's just a note of caution when we're offering somebody 100% leverage and could potentially put them upside down in our efforts to help them hurt them by doing that. So I'll leave it at that.
Madam Chair, Representative Braun, I would add that as we're working with our clients who become delinquent, we try to be very sensitive in employing early intervention efforts and meeting with them face-to-face, taking a look at sometimes there's a very good reason why they've become delinquent. Perhaps a service-connected disability has become worsened and they haven't been able to work or a number of different things. So we try to take a look at that and offer our services in it, making sure that they are receiving all the veterans' benefits to which they are entitled. So I think that has helped with delinquencies. It's one of the things that we do and would certainly do with any of our loans. But thank you.
Have we had to foreclose on veterans?
Madam Chair, yes, we have had to foreclose before. It's a very unpleasant thing to ever have to do because we're certainly there to provide those loans to the veterans, but sometimes circumstances are such that that's what occurs.
Well, when that does occur, do we have a process where we find them other housing if we have to foreclose rental property, go to the state and community housing, or what do we do for those people? I mean, they've
take that one?
Sure.
Done so much for us. I hope we have a system.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there actually is a statute in place. I can't tell you the citation. Basically, again, to reemphasize, doing everything we can to work with the veterans.
Do we have any bridge money available to help them get through a tough situation? I heard today that 50% of the 430,000 Guard who've gone to Iraq and Afghanistan are now being paid one half or less of what they were making in the commercial world when they were called up. So I can understand some of them may have $2,000 a month house payments and all of a sudden can't meet them. So are there bridge funds available when we demand that, we got to go somewhere, fight a war?
Madam Chair, no, we do not have bridge money for them.
Madam Chair, we do have within our ability to do temporarily reduce their monthly payment under certain circumstances.
Oh, good.
So we have done that for borrowers.
Thank you so much. And Donna, if I went to Iraq, and I'm sorry that I haven't been able to do that yet, but as a civilian, but if I were in the Guard and I went to Iraq or in reserves, and I'm on the 29th day, I'm injured and flown to Germany for the hospital and then back here, would I get a medal and be able to get a home loan?
Okay. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, would you get a medal, was the question?
Expeditionary medal, which would then entitle... I've only been there 29 days.
Okay.
In the combat zone. So would I qualify?
If you're injured, and I can't really answer that. I should defer that to Paula because she has been in the service. But if you're injured, there certainly is going to be another category that you're going to be falling in. I'm going to let Paula go with that one, though, because she can answer that better.
There would, Madam Chair, there's not a requirement of 30 days in a combat zone. If you served one day in a combat zone or an area where there was an expeditionary medal awarded for that service, whether that person were injured or not. If they go there and they're injured, so it was really two issues. If they serve there, they're entitled to the expeditionary medal. They're eligible for a home loan.
If they serve 4 hours,
if they serve
injured,
4 hours,
they get the medal and they're qualified.
That is correct. If the other thing would be if they were injured and left because of that service-connected disability, they would be also eligible for the home loan.
What if something occurred while they're being retrained at Fort Lewis or Bragg or, help me, Representative Boakless?
Any of those locations.
Okay. What if I've been mobilized, but I get injured, I'm going to the war, but like right now, any of those who are being trained for maintenance,
for example,
if they got hurt here stateside, do they qualify?
Madam Chair, are you referring to an Oregon National Guard?
Uh-huh.
If they did not serve in an area of a theater of operations for which an expeditionary medal was authorized, then no. If they were injured before they went and did not serve in that theater of operations, then no, they would not be entitled to that, unless they had met the requirement for...
Previously.
Correct, for the number of days.
Thank you. The reason I'm asking that question to the committee is because the definition of a veteran is very important to us. We bring that up on Thursday, and we want to be sure that we have done everything we can do stateside, or state of Oregon, to be sure that, you know, these individuals qualify for as many benefits as possible, because we have done so little for so long for our military in the state. Now's the time. And in talking with General Pritt this week, or last Friday, he was telling me that the number one item, as he's talked to many of the men and women, is education and, you know, training. So we want to be sure that, and for this benefit, we want to be sure that veterans qualify, that we have the, you know, some bridge funds to assist them, so we don't have the spouse of one of our military stand on the street for a year with a cup. That's a disgrace, and it's despicable. I can't even think of enough bad words to say about that. Right? Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, can
yes. Representative Hunt, I never did call on you, but I will. Now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You referenced that some additional loan products would potentially become available by moving from the 97% to 100%. Are those additional loan products with lower rates or additional advantages, or just a wider pool of lenders that you would be accessing?
Madam Chair, Representative Hunt, actually what I'm referring to is being able to make the 100% loans would be an additional loan product available to the borrower.
Okay.
In addition to the 97% or whatever other loan they may choose to get.
If I could ask,
yes, please.
Follow up on another piece of your testimony. You referenced the fact that other folks within your existing pool of potential borrowers would be able to access home loans. what is your sense of what's currently happening with those folks today? Do you think those folks are just not getting a home and just continuing to rent? Are they going out on the private market and therefore defaulting? What's your sense of the additional pool of people that within your pool that would be eligible for this, what they're doing today?
Madam Chair, Representative Hunt, I would guess there's probably a mixture. There probably are those who continue to rent because they're not able to qualify for a loan. There may be also those who do go some other avenue. The ones that we're hoping to help are the ones who haven't purchased a home by some other method. But there are a lot of other loan products available, so some probably do that. I have no idea what their delinquency rate might be, but I hope that answers your question.
Donna, is there an income level requirement in the qualifier?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, there is. We do follow, and I've tried, I always say Fannie Mae, Federal National Mortgage Association. We actually follow their guidelines, and those guidelines are very strict on what you can and can't do in regards to your income versus your...
What's the entry income level that would qualify an individual for a first home?
I don't think there really is one. I say that cautiously because it's...
I want to be sure they're getting paid enough by the...
Right. We want to make sure they can make the payment. You know, we're not going to get them in a high risk. We look to their welfare, too. And as Representative Bruin, I hope I pronounced that correctly, commented, you know, we're not... This is a higher risk loan for ourselves and for the borrower. We don't hope to put them into it unless they... Typically what we find is it's not that people can't qualify or have the money to qualify, or the income that is to qualify, or the credit that is substantial. That's not the issue. The issue is getting the money to put down. And therefore, with the default insurance, it kind of protects us for that. And
so do we have to be making $30,000 a year, $25,000 to qualify?
It depends on how much of a house you're buying.
$100,000 home.
Okay. Again, we're going to look at their credit.
$37,000. I didn't think I'd ever get in it.
Okay, as a rule of thumb, I suppose you could do a percentage. There's a lot of factors that play into the underwriting piece. There used to be real, 28% of your gross monthly income, your principal interest payment shouldn't exceed 28%. But that can be moved around depending on your credit and your income.
And can you tell me, can you buy mobile homes, fifth-wheelers, motor homes through this program?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, no, you can buy a manufactured home on land. It has to be real property.
Purchased land?
That's correct.
Not rented land?
No.
Okay. Yeah, Representative Bray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to follow real quickly on closing costs and what yours are, if any, and is it a percent, a half a percent? Is there anything about closing costs?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Bruin, our closing costs are actually, if you want to look at, I'm speaking to your banking background probably here. We have a loan origination fee. It changes depending on whether or not you want to put 4.99, for example, right now is a 1.5% loan fee. 5 1/8 would be a 1% loan fee. The qualifying, the other minimal closing costs are the general ones, your title insurance, your recording fees. As far as a percent, we're a little bit lower than the rest because we don't have the industry term analogy for junk fees. We have we don't have a lot of those.
Don't you ever wonder why we get title insurance? It doesn't mean anything. I've never understood that in my life.
Madam Chairman, I could help you with that at a later date if you'd like. I'd be glad to explain title insurance and the importance of it.
Madam Chair, can I follow up on it? I'm sorry. I hate to keep beating a dead horse here. Do you loan on those closing fees?
No, we do not.
You do not loan on the closing costs?
That's in addition. So that could, okay, on a $100,000 home, yeah, Representative Bruin, what would that be?
The closing costs?
Yeah.
Well, it's 1%.
That's it? Total, but that's only the originating fee.
That's correct.
So to get in a home...
The fees work out to a little less than 3% of what you're borrowing.
3%
of what you're borrowing.
Of what you're borrowing. Okay.
Yeah, Madam Chair, the reason I ask that question is because most home loans do let you borrow your closing costs, if you will.
Oh.
And so as we go to 100% loan-to-value, that frightens me because that would certainly push us past that 100%.
I see.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think I need to take just a second to correct and clarify a piece of my testimony. As far as the service member who, en route to Iraq or Afghanistan, were injured, if that service member were discharged on account of that service-connected injury, then they would qualify for a loan. I just wanted to make sure that I was clear on that. They may have been injured and not discharged, but if they are actually discharged on account of that service-connected injury, then they would qualify for an Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs home loan.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Okay, I'll call on Mac McDonald.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matt McDonald. I represent five veterans organizations. Basically, the way I read this bill, it evens the playing field and puts us even with the lending institutions that are out there, which allows a veteran to go to a veterans organization to get the loan, whereby if this bill does not pass, then it would be a better deal for the veteran not to go to the Department of Veterans Affairs, but to go to a lending institution. So we propose that it's a due pass, and that the lending field is now even.
Thank you very much. I needed to ask the three from the Department of Veteran Affairs. Did I get a yes, you are for this measure?
Yes,
as it stands. Thank you. That's good to hear. Yes, yes, yes. Thank you, Mr. McDonald. And Mr. Cruz?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I thank you for this opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 223. For the record, I'm Walter Cruz. I'm a Master Sergeant, United States Air Force, retired. I'm the legislative representative for the Noncommissioned Officers Association and the spokesperson for the United Veterans Groups of Oregon. Myself and the ones I represent are all in favor of this bill, and we would like to see it pass out with a two-pass recommendation. Just for information, my son is currently applied for a VA or a ODVA home loan, and his problem right now is raising the 3% down payment. He can make the monthly payments no problem. Between he and his wife, they have a substantial income, but it's getting the down payment, and this bill would help them quite a bit. In fact, if it were in effect now, he could go ahead and buy a home.
Well, we appreciate this testimony. Any questions? Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
Sergeant Cruz. Is that what I say? Did I say that right?
Master
Sergeant Cruz. I have to say Master
Sergeant. He's at the top end.
Walter is fine.
Okay. Thank you, Walter. All right. Is there any other testimony? Well, if not, we will proceed. I'll close the public testimony now on Senate Bill 223 and open the work session on Senate Bill 223. Representative Barnhart.
Madam Chair, I move that we send Senate Bill 223 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Are there any objections?
I want to ask the discussion.
Okay. May we have a roll call vote, Aaron? Please.
Representative Bowman.
Yes.
Representative Bruce.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Excuse.
Representative Hunt.
Aye.
Representative Cox.
Aye.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Chair Nelson.
Yes, for the veterans. Thank you so much. All right, this Senate Bill 223 increases the maximum veterans home loan amount to 100% of the net appraised value on homes that are real property. And for the veterans, I hope they have a greater and broader future because of the efforts in the legislature to make that possible. And thank all of those who testified. I'll close the work session. If there is no further business, I will adjourn. Thank you, this committee.
Thank you very much.